The Guardian.
I'm Andy Tucker, the Assistant Director of the University of Cambridge Centre for Gender Studies, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the last of our three dialogues between leading international experts and the public on gender and the biomedical advances of the 21st century. This event is organised by University of Cambridge Centre for Gender Studies in association with The Guardian newspaper and is kindly supported by Cambridge University Press. So, to tonight's topic, transitioning gender, the challenges of radical technologies. The exact definition of terms such as transgender, transsexual, and intersex are often debated in terms of what they mean, especially in relation to transitional sex surgery. I will leave the detailed discussion of these terms to tonight's expert panel, but by way of introduction, I will simply refer to the Oxford English Dictionary here. Transgender can mean those individuals whose identity does not conform unambiguously to conventional notions of male or female gender, but combines or moves between these. Transsexual can mean those individuals who have physical characteristics of one sex and psychological characteristics of the other. Intersex can mean those individuals who have both male and female characteristics. Our chair this evening is Natalie Hanman, who is the editor of Comment is Free, The Guardian's online comment and debate website. So please join me in welcoming her.
Good evening, and thank you all for coming tonight. I'll briefly introduce our panel before handing the floor over to each speaker in turn, and then I'll be coming to you for questions, so do keep thinking of things you might like to ask as our panel speak. So over here on my far left, we have Richard Green. He's a former research director and consultant psychiatrist at the Gender Identity Clinic at Charing Cross Hospital. Professor Green is an expert on gender dysphoria, sexual identity, and transsexual families, and a leading advocate of sexual reassignment surgery. On my left here is Jens Sherpa, a specialist in the legal ramifications of sex assignment surgery across Europe and in the Faculty of Law at the University of Cambridge. On my right, we have Jack Halberstam, who's a key thinker on the politics of transgender identity and rights and director of the Center for Feminist Research at the University of California, San Diego. And on my far right, we have Ben Tom, who's a vice president of Press for Change, the largest trans advocacy group in the UK. He's also been a key advisor to the government's Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity Advisory Group. So, Richard, should we start with you? Tell us what the latest transition sex surgery can do and what will be possible in the future. And also, who decides which patients should be permitted to undergo transition surgery?
Well, I have all of 10 minutes to do this. I usually rant on this topic for about an hour or so. Condensing is very difficult. I now understand what Pascal wrote in the 17th century, often attributed to Mark Twain, but it wasn't Mark Twain. He wrote, "I have made this letter longer than usual, only because I have not had time to make it shorter." The desire to change sex is not new. Venus Castina was the Greek goddess associated with the yearnings of feminine souls locked up in male bodies. More recently, however, in 1966, the Johns Hopkins Hospital in the U.S. instituted a major sex change, sex reassignment program. It was written up in the New York Times and Worldwide Press, and this ushered in the, if you will, the modern era of sex reassignment. With much less fanfare at the same time, here in London at Charing Cross Hospital, there was also a sex reassignment program going on, which without the New York Times publicity. The Hopkins surgeons are famed for two quotes at the time, which was published in the papers. One rationalizing the surgery, quote, "If we can't change the mind to fit the body, we must change the body to fit the mind." And the second quote comparing the challenges of surgery from male to female versus female to male, more appropriate for tonight, the surgeon said, unhappily perhaps, "It's easier to build a hole than a pole." Simulating female genitalia was obviously much easier. Cosmetically, it was excellent. Scrotal skin was used for labial folds, penile skin inverted for vaginal neovagina. But there were problems, narrowing, shortening, and so for many patients. And more recently, intestinal loop has been used for neovagina for some patients, which the length can be determined by the surgeon. The width is fine, and it also self-lubricates. and also more recently a neoclitoris can be placed from the penile skin, where it's particularly sensitive, to essentially where the clitoris ought to be. Female-to-male surgery, however, certainly early on, was much less successful cosmetically and functionally. In the last decade, there's been much improvement. What one surgeon calls the Rolls-Royce approach takes a forearm graft of muscle, blood vessel, and nerves. And when this works, it is a very credible neophallus with sensation going down at least half of the neophallus, urination from the end of the organ and in the standing position, and erection is possible from a hydraulic implant in which there's a reservoir of fluid in the scrotum, which when pressed pushes fluid up into the phallus, and that allows vaginal penetration. Now, at this point in my talks, I generally show a lot of very sexy slides, erotic slides, showing all these things, but I know that they were on radio and they don't transmit very well. I was told that I could actually describe rather graphically what the slides showed for the audience, but I think this is probably not a winning idea. For the future, tissue engineering is a buzzword in biomedical science. And what this does is utilizes undifferentiated cells, for example, stem cells, puts them on a scaffolding, which then dissolves. And the idea is that it's possible to build new organs from tissues from the person's own body so that there would not be tissue rejection. If this becomes a possibility, then it would be possible to actually form a penis with cavernous erectile capacity within, like, a male-born penis. And might also be possible then to form a uterus for male-to-female patients who might want, in fact, to have pregnancy and childbirth. Now, so far, the organs that have been created from biomedical engineering have been an esophagus and a bladder. But they're getting closer to moving at least in the right direction anatomically. Sex hormones. By contrast to surgery, hormone treatment has been more efficient for the birth female. Okay? Testosterone, the male hormone, can deepen voice of a natal female to sound like a man, growth of facial hair, and in fact male pattern baldness. By contrast, estrogen, the female hormone, given to a birth male, has no effect on voice, minimal effect on facial hair. There is, however, breast development, not as much as hoped for by many patients, but that's true for birth females as well. The new area of controversy deals with adolescents just entering puberty who still have substantial gender dysphoria. Clinical experience shows that those persons who enter in puberty who are very gender dysphoric, who want to change sex, remain this way into adulthood. The problem then becomes puberty. The wrong puberty then kicks in for a lot of adolescent persons with gender dysphoria. And it's traumatic at the time it occurs, and particularly if the individual continues to want to change sex, particularly for the birth male, the stigmata of male puberty are great obstacles towards successfully integrating socially as a woman. The height, facial hair, Adam's apple, and voice change. So what is happening in more recent years, at least in Amsterdam, to some extent in the U.S., is a drug can be given which puts puberty on hold. It's a pubertal suspension for a year or two. It's a timeout. It's a breathing period for the individual to negotiate intrapsychically with a counselor, with family, as to whether one wants to continue on a path of sex reassignment. If so, the pubertal drug is withdrawn and cross-sex hormones are given, and the right puberty kicks in. If, however, during the timeout period, the individual decides to go back to birth sex, the pubertal blockade drug is withdrawn and natural puberty kicks in. Okay, who decides on who should have these treatments? I'll give you two quotes that show two different approaches to individual autonomy. One is John Stuart Mill, 19th century, who wrote, "As soon as any part of a person's conduct affects prejudicially the interest of others, society has jurisdiction over it. But there's no room for entertaining any such question when a person's conduct affects the interests of no persons besides himself. All errors which he is likely to commit are far outweighed by the evil of allowing others to constrain him to what they deem is good." In contrast, a couple centuries earlier was John Donne, who wrote, "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent. Any man's death diminishes me. Therefore, never ask for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Now, what criteria for sex reassignment? The Standards of Care is a consensus document originally formulated by the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association a couple decades ago. I was involved in the first edition of that. It's now gone through half a dozen more, and I'm no longer involved in it. But a core part of the Standards of Care is the so-called real-life experience or real-life test. This is a requirement that the person, prior to surgery, live at least a year, full-time, in the desired gender role, living that way with hormone treatment, but not yet having the surgery. The Gender Identity Clinic at Charing Cross typically requires a two-year real-life experience with 1 year full-time employment, 1 year full-time education in the desired gender role. Now, should physicians have a say in who progresses the surgery? Is the need to change sex a medical disorder? About 14 years ago in this country, an NHS trust said that transsexualism, whatever it might be called, is not a medical disorder. And if it is, whatever Charing Cross or others were doing was not particularly helpful. Okay? I wrote a 20-page affidavit at the time supporting the position of three persons who wanted to become patients and wanted to have sex reassignment surgery, but the NHS Trust refused to do it. We won. The NHS Trust lost their trial, and they also lost on appeal. And the decision was at the High Court that transsexuals cannot be categorically deleted from the National Health Service treatment. Parenthetically, the amount of money that the Trust lost on the trial, losing again on appeal, with all the money they spent, they probably could have changed sex of everybody in their catchment area. Yes, there are things you can do to your body without medical approval. For example, piercing, tattooing, but the NHS won't pay for that. Is surgery on demand possible? Yes. If you have a few thousand pounds, and it helps if you like Thai food, you can go to Bangkok. The surgeons there are not very strict on whether an individual has experienced the real-life test, the real-life experience, but I would add that they're very, very good surgeons. Is the real-life experience necessary for all persons? Probably not, but it does reduce the risk of tragedy. The few people I've seen who have been disasters, suicidal, after sex reassignment surgery, the few I've seen have, in fact, been people who did not have anything resembling a real-life test. Also, with the Internet, many persons now self-medicate, and they follow online advice. But a real Mark Twain quote might be appropriate here. Mark Twain wrote, "Be careful about reading health books. You may die of a misprint." I'll close with one clinical issue that's become more relevant in recent years, the so-called, if you will, a third gender or no gender persons. These are, for example, females who want breast removal only or males who want castration only. This presents a medical dilemma for physicians because there's no real life experience. It's either surgery or not. Okay? So how is that decision made? Well, perhaps there are three elements. One, how persuasive is the patient's argument? Two, how much money does the person have, if necessary, for private care? And probably three as well, whether the surgeon is named John Stuart Mill or John Dunn.
Thank you, Richard. Jens, would you like to tell us what the UK law says about the legal status of those who have transitional sex surgery and how this compares to other countries?
Yes. Well, thank you. Yes. The legal question in principle seems to be a very simple one. Can a person change his or her legal gender from the one he or she was registered with at birth? Now, since April 2005, in this jurisdiction, the Gender Recognition Act 2004 allows you to do that. And the Act actually is a very liberal one in comparison to most such acts in Europe. And that at first actually is somewhat surprising given what we've just heard and actually given the very fierce resistance of this jurisdiction to gender recognition, or rather successive governments, we should say. And it's only when the Goodwin decision by the European Court of Human Rights effectively forced the government to do something they did. But before I go into the detail of the legislation as such, it's probably necessary to look at the legal development in Europe because that actually plays a great part in what we have today. And as so often is the case in family law, it starts in the Nordic countries. So in 1972, Sweden, as the very first country in Europe, introduced legislation to allow for a change of legal gender under certain circumstances. So the Swedish statute in 1972, approximately 40 years ago, specified a number of requirements that had to be fulfilled before a gender different from the one registered at birth could actually be recognized. So the first one is that the person needed to have felt a sense of belonging to the other gender since his or her youth, and also that this person needed to have lived in that gender for a considerable period of time. So no specific time limit, but a considerable period. Further then, the person had to be at least 18 years old and infertile, either through natural occurrence or through an operation. And finally, the Act was only open to Swedish nationals, so only Swedish nationals could transition legally, and there needed to be transitional sex surgery, and the person needed to be unmarried, and after the registered partnership in Sweden was introduced, also not living in a registered partnership. Now, by today's standards, this seems rather restrictive, but we do need to keep in mind that that was 1972, so at that time, Sweden was the only country in the world, literally, to have legislation on this, so they were rather cautious. And also, of course, since 1972, medical and psychological research have greatly advanced the understanding of society and lawmakers and the acceptance of issues like intersexuality and transsexuality. So we can't really judge this early statute by today's standards. The next country, then, is a big surprise, because it was actually Germany. Now, we don't see Germany usually at the forefront of legal development and family law, but actually, since the last World War, in Germany, there's an acute awareness of the importance of human rights, and they're enshrined in the German constitution and protected by a very, very strong constitutional court. And actually, it's the court that played a major role in the development of transgender law in Germany. So in 1980, Germany introduced the Transgender Act. And the preceding parliamentary debates very clearly show the lack of understanding, mildly put, and lack of knowledge of the medical, psychological issue by many people at the time. And I have a nice quote from one member by the Christian Conservative Party in the upper house of the German parliament at the time. He argued that the act should not be passed because so far it has been impossible to distinguish transsexualism from other phenomena such as homosexuality and transvestitism, which, by the way, is not a word in German. So... nevertheless, the Act passed, and it's not unsurprising that obviously the German legislator looked towards Sweden because that was the only Act that existed, and there's a clear resemblance of this Act to the Swedish one in Germany. So the conditions are nationality, had to be German, having lived according to the perceived gender for at least 3 years, German's always precise, you have to have exact numbers, then requiring transitional sex surgery, being unmarried, and finally, and that's somewhat more restrictive than Sweden, an age limit of 25 years. Now, several of these conditions have been challenged in the German Constitutional Court, and successfully. So the age limit of 25 went in 1993, was held to be unconstitutional because it violated the principle of equality before the law. So no age limit anymore in Germany on that front, so even minors can change their legal gender if the requirements otherwise are fulfilled. The limitations on German citizens was found to be unconstitutional in 2006. And most recently, and most surprisingly, it was held that the requirement to be unmarried actually violated the personality rights of the complainants and their constitutionally protected marriage because they already had entered into a marriage and from that moment on that marriage was protected. What Germany will do with this decision, we're not quite sure yet, but it will certainly change the law. The next country then, again a bit surprising, Italy, 1982, followed by the Netherlands, not so surprising, 1985, and then Turkey, really surprising, in 1988, and so on. So I can't discuss all these statutes in detail, but the Dutch one is remarkable because it did not specify for the first time a nationality requirement, but merely required you to reside in the jurisdiction for at least a year. And also, and that's probably more interesting, while all other statutes so far in Europe required you to be sterile and undergo surgery, the Dutch statute actually stated that it was not necessary, only necessary as far as it is medically and psychologically feasible to have the operation. And that meant for the very first time in Europe, surgery was no longer mandatory for the change of a legal gender. course, the exception is rather narrow, and we don't really know of any cases actually in practice, but it was there. So then by and by, more countries in Europe, one after the other, introduced legislation. Now, some European jurisdictions, being more flexible than others, including Denmark and France, took a rather pragmatic approach, and that did not require an act of parliament. They said, well, correcting the birth certificate is sort of rectifying an administrative error. So the person having undergone transitional surgery would simply ask the relevant authorities to acknowledge that the gender that they have now is different from the one they had at birth. So obviously the birth certificate is false now, and then it needed to be corrected, and then that was done, and that was the change of legal gender. But the overview as such shows that in Europe the issues are very similar. It's always nationality, it's age, it's surgery requirement, infertility, and pre-existing marriage. And that's a pattern you see in all the jurisdictions. But more importantly, what we also saw in Europe before the turn of the century is a clear development, a convergence in Europe towards the recognition of a change of legal gender. But one country put up fierce resistance, the United Kingdom. The refusal by this country to allow change of legal gender even after the NHS started paying for it was challenged several times in the European Court of Human Rights. And these and a few other cases actually led to European lawyers joking that if the case had the word sex in it, it probably came from the United Kingdom. No sex, please, we're British, obviously. But in 2002... the European Court finally held in the famous Goodwin case that in the light of the convergence in Europe on this specific issue, the convention as a living instrument now needed to be interpreted such that it required the possibility of a legal change of gender. The modalities of this, of course, were left to the individual contracting states. In England, it took another case in the House of Lords, namely Ballinger and Bellinger, where the English law at the time was declared incompatible with the European Convention. But then Parliament acted and enacted the Gender Recognition Act. Now, at this stage, for this, they could actually build on 40 years of experience in Europe and other jurisdictions, and, of course, on the significant medical and psychological research now available. So, according to the United Kingdom Act, and actually it's not only England, it covers the entire United Kingdom, in order to get a gender recognition certificate, and the term is a bit misleading, I find, but there we are, which effects a change of the legal gender, you basically need to have fulfilled certain conditions. You must be 18 years old, you must have lived in the other gender for 2 years before making the application, and you must intend to live in the new gender, although, of course, it can be argued whether it's new, to live in the other gender until death. There must be sufficient evidence, namely two reports, that you suffer from gender dysphoria. Now, if you're married or in a civil partnership, then the full recognition certificate will not be issued until that union has been dissolved. So you need to get divorced or or annulled, having a relationship annulled. And then, of course, you're free to sort of remarry according to the new gender and so on. There are more practical ways to do this, but that's the way we chose it to be. But we can see that, like many other countries, the UK has opted for an age limit of 18 years. It has opted for a marriage civil partnership bar in order to prevent same-sex marriages and opposite-sex civil partnerships. But there is no nationality requirement, and most importantly, the Gender Recognition Act does not in any way require transitional sex surgery or sterility of an applicant. And that essentially means that in the United Kingdom, a person who's legally a man can give birth to a child. And that leaves one other important question unresolved. Is that man giving birth to the child legally then the father or the mother of the child? And what is the status of the partner? Is it mother or father, as the case may be, or simply other parent, which of course is not so charming? And we could, of course, ask whether that should really matter, but at the moment it does matter, because particularly if you're unmarried, it makes a big difference whether you're legally classified as mother or father of a child. So that's a puzzle the current legislation leaves us with, and actually one that provides a very interesting challenge to the way we perceive gender in society and, of course, in law. Thank you.
Jack, you're going to talk about what the new medical advances in transitional sex surgery mean for the concepts of gender, sexuality, and identity.
Yeah, I think what I'm going to do is try to represent the way in which gender theorists have talked about some of these same topics. And what you'll hear is something quite different from the medical diagnostic system that Richard's described and the legal system that first requires people to sort of identify themselves as a problem in order for the law to then fix the problem. And in both cases, it's similar. Both in medicine and in law, you first have to be identified as a problem in order for either medicine or the law to come in and fix the problem. Now, in neither case are we hearing that, in fact, it is the structure of gender that, by the way, impacts every single body in the society, not only transsexual bodies or transgender bodies, that maybe has some problematic features to it. So if it's the case that we have a binary gender system that doesn't well describe the range of gender identifications that people take up, then presumably we have a problem with the system, not with the individuals who fall out of place. And there's a real problem, I think, with taking the figure of the transsexual and marking the transsexual as somebody who has a problem when, in fact, what we might be talking about is the way in which the transsexual is symptomatic of a problem that is spread across the whole discourse. We could be talking about the problem of violence and the way that it gets encased within heterosexual masculinity. That seems like a massive problem to me and something in need of a diagnosis, something that is pathological and something that we should probably give a name to. Or the fact that a lot of heterosexual femininities seem really weighed down by a sort of dependency complex. That seems like a real problem and something that one might want to identify not, again, within individuals, but with the system as a whole. So let me open with that polemic in order to try to open up the questions beyond what are the doctors doing for us poor people who seem to be at odds with the gender system, and instead changing the focus so that we can ask questions about a gender system that doesn't even well describe the kinds of sex formations that occur, quote unquote, naturally. And so a term like intersex, for example, which describes something like 3% of all births that involve ambiguous genitalia, gives the lie to a binary gender system that claims that there are two genders based upon two sexes. As Anne Fausto-Stirling said in an article on quite a while ago in Science magazine, there are at least five sexes that actually occur within human bodies, and you could have a gender system based upon all five if you're going to correlate one-to-one the sex of the body and the determinant social gender. There's other work in gender studies that actually sees sex, the way that we think about sex, as a consequence of gender ideology rather than gender as a consequence of sex, if you see what I mean. If you already think that there are only two options, male or female, then when you see a sexed body, you're reading it through that lens, that ideological lens. That's the big claim made by Judith Butler, for example, in Gender Trouble, that had a huge impact on the ways in which people talked about gender, and that book came out, I think, in 1989. So what I really want to stress in my time is that we all live in a gender system that has places where it works very well and places where it doesn't, places where it describes very well a varied and diverse population, and places where it is anachronistic and is out of sync with the ways in which people occupy gender space. The need for two genders, okay, sounds like a legal need to identify parenthood, identify relations in a system that allows marriage for some people but not others. But individuals themselves may or may not need to be placed within a binary gender system. Some radical gender theorists argue, Kate Bornstein, for example, argue that we really shouldn't be assigning gender to little infant bodies. We should be allowing people to develop into gender identities. And, you know, Kate Bornstein's line is that, you know, what gender is your child? He or she will tell you once he or she has figured it out. So you could let kids go through adolescence and then tell you what their social gender is going to be, rather than looking to see who falls out of the system and then naming them a problem in order to consolidate some mythic norm. So my work in recent years is really about expanding the purview of gender studies away from these so-called problem cases, i.e. the transsexual is a really particular place where so much pathologizing attention has been focused, to turn the attention away from that and to understand that heterosexuality and homosexuality are always in a dynamic relationship to one another. Transsexuality and gender normativity are always in a dynamic relationship to one another. So if there are changes in one place in terms of the sex-gender system, there are inevitably changes elsewhere. So let me give you some examples. In the 60s and 70s, as it became more and more popular for particularly female-to-male transsexuals to come out as transsexual, there also developed a large community of transgender people. And these are not no-gender people, as Richard said, or third gender. That presumes there are three genders, okay? And transgender is already trying to avoid the language of third gender and no gender. Transgender describes, in fact, a whole range of gender identifications that might be taken up within a community in relationship to these particular poles, like transsexuality or gender normativity. But you could say that some people, for example, if you wanted to not use valued language, value-laden language, you could say some people have a stable gender and others don't, okay? What about people who, over the course of a lifetime, change their orientation, their sexual orientation? When there are a huge percentage of lesbians come out as lesbians well into their 40s and 50s. So what was their heterosexuality? Was that a lie? Or are they, in fact, people whose orientation is not so stable? Lots of people's genders change over the course of their lifetime. And if you just look around at your friends or your aging parents or your own life course, you'll see that at various times you may have been more feminine, you may have been more masculine. So we might think about flexibility across a lifespan. We might think about gender norms as applicable to labor. What if you're a truck driver, a female truck driver? You may not want nails. You know, if you're driving a truck or if you're doing manual labor, you may need a different gender style. So there are many things that gender identity is dependent upon beyond some notion of a core identity that gets settled so quickly and then determines the course of your life. Many, many things change and some things get fixed. The big mystery is why do some people get fixed in a gender identity or a sexual orientation? Why do some people not? So, for example, if we go all the way back to Freud, when in the three essays, he wrote that it seems that the problem with homosexuality is its exclusivity. And then he has a long footnote, and he says, but then again, exclusivity is a problem for heterosexuals. So if we're going to say exclusivity is the problem, that's a problem across the whole population of people who imagine that they only want sex with they only want to have sex with partners of one particular sex, right? So it's exclusivity that becomes the problem. So we could talk about flexibility, rigidity, stability. We could talk about changing gender norms. We could talk about change over the course of the lifetime in order to get away from this figure, this benighted figure of the transsexual who is forced to bear all of the problems that the society actually has already constructed around mismatches of sex and gender. Inevitably, if there are two choices and you've already decided that these people with these bodies must make this choice and these people with these bodies must make that choice, some people will cross-identify. There's absolutely no way to prevent it. What's more, we live in cultures that really try to organize people's gender identities in very, very coercive ways. So one only has to look at the deployment of the color pink for little girls, which is an epidemic, okay? And to say there's something really conditioned about femininity. There is nothing natural in a world where all three-year-old girls want pink and only pink, but boys understand that they have the entire spectrum of colors in front of them, right? So if gender is such a natural thing and it simply follows from your bodily morphology, then you shouldn't need all of these tricks to produce normatively gendered subjects. But we do need these kinds of enforcements and disciplines to produce gender normative subjects. And therefore, we should not be surprised when some people opt out. Those people could be thought about as gender rebels or as people who are eccentric or as people who have found the flaw in the system, or as people who are pioneering, as people who are brave, as people who are dangerous. There are all kinds of ways one could think about it outside of the logic of norm and pathology. And this is a very, very limiting framework, and it's a framework that gender studies has worked hard to resist. So in conclusion, I think that these terms are very meaningful. You know, it is important for some young kids to have a term like transsexuality in order to understand why they have internalized a particular gender identity that seems to be at odds with bodily morphology. But we shouldn't be so sure that that process is part of some kind of dysfunction or dysphoria. We actually should see it as part of the very same process that produces gender normativity. We should see transgenderism as a vernacular, community, almost grassroots response to the medicalization and the legalization of these kinds of gender regulations. And transgender communities have actually sprung up to contest this notion of norms and pathologies and have been very creative in the ways in which they have understood the meaning, the construction, and the embodiment of gender. Intersex people have been, you know, really, in a way, victimized by a binary gender system because often they're getting surgeries when there's nothing medically wrong with them. So by the time you're 15, if you've had 17 surgeries on your genitalia, you might be forgiven for having some problems in relationship to your sex gender identity. So there are many, many different outcomes for contrary gender and sexual orientation, gender identification and sexual orientation. Many, many other outcomes if we're creative enough to imagine them, think about them, and recognize that they're already in practice all around us. Thank you.
Ben, the technological advances, how have they or have they impacted on trans activism?
Thank you. My first response to this would have been to actually write a very short response. Rather, what I want to do is to step back from this question and really sort of have a look at some of the basic issues that prevent access to advanced technologies, because that's the real problem. I mean, certainly some leading writers and academics involved in trans studies and theories of gender development cite that the emergence of transsexualism in the mid-20th century depended on technological developments in endocrinology and plastic surgery, as if there was no trans people before. Perhaps an early example, you might say, of trans activism portrayed, for instance, by Holzman in her book Changing Sex, is the characteristic demand, as she sees it, by transsexuals for surgery following Christian Jorgensen's 1952 public transformation in the press. So, surgical interventions have, in fact, a much older history. The earliest attempt to create an artificial vagina was recorded by Marshall in 1913 as occurring in 1761. One wonders what material they used. A penis was transplanted by the Chinese in the 1900s, although tissue rejection caused the demise of the recipient. Equally, castration was popular and has a long history, surviving to the present day, and may become more prominent in this new age of health rationing and austerity. In addressing the question in hand concerning the impact of medical technologies on trans activism, it's predicated on trans people having information, choice, and access to medical technological advances in surgery and treatments. And it makes the assumption that all trans people either want or require some form of medical intervention or treatment, when this is not the case. Stigma still prevails around sex change surgery, and those that do not conform to binary gender is increasingly problematic in an era where LGBT rights and equality have been legislated and mainstreamed into our society. Who would challenge openly the desire for same-sex couples to have children or IVF, yet deny NHS treatment for transgender people? Well, 84% of doctors, of 1,000 doctors surveyed on doctors.net in 2007, did just that, and they believed gender reassignment should not be funded by the NHS. Without positive attitudinal shift in the medical profession, in particular GPs, access to health treatment and advancing medical technology will continue to be anxiety-laden and difficult to obtain. When considering trans activism in the relatively recent UK context, it was necessitated, as we gathered, by punitive regulation and control by the church, state and medicine, such that trans people had no legitimate identity, no protection in employment and other social spheres. It is widely accepted in the trans community that the pathologization and labelling of transsexual people as a mental disorder in the DSM-3 in 1974, whilst removing homosexuality, is a current cofactor in ensuring that stigma and ignorance of trans people continues to affect all trans people's lives at the expense of their human rights to self-determination, respect and dignity enshrined in Article 8 of the Convention. Yet equally, there is a fear in the community that the removal of this psychiatric category will lead to an absence of medical diagnosis that in turn will result in clinicians, and in particular the NHS, being unable or refusing to offer medical treatment. A simple solution to reclassify their supposed gender dysphoric and intersex, part of the all-encompassing gender identity disorders, into the general medical sphere by using the category congenital endocrinological disorder in the next revision of the World Health Organization International Classification of Diseases, has not received the serious attention it deserves by healthcare professionals and clinicians. I noticed by people generally, trans people are acutely aware that gender identity is scrutinised and policed from the moment we're born, and an M or F is assigned to our birth certificates. It's still the case that if you are an intersex person or a female-bodied assigned female at birth and decide that you wish, need to live and be recognised as a man, then you must ask the state's permission to do so by presenting a legitimate medical reason. This is not the case for sexual orientation. Consenting adults need no permission or state intervention. Likewise, for someone without a gender identity conflict, it's a non-issue. Despite problems in expressing and realising a trans identity or gender opposite to the one assigned at birth, trans people increasingly network and are active in community groups. I see some here tonight. And local campaigns, albeit often sporadic and intermittent, especially in areas away from the big cities. Information and information exchange between trans people and trans communities is improving. Trans people are of necessity knowledgeable and well-informed as they strive to understand themselves and the systems that control them. Yet access to treatment, much less access to new technology, has not radically improved compared to the last 10 years. Partly due to increased demand, patient demand for gender identity treatment doubles every 5 years. The current demand for gender services continues to grow at 15% per annum. Underfunding within specialist commissioning is a further problem, as is the lack of properly funded medical research into assessing and using the potential of new technology, such as lab-generated organs and soft tissue, to benefit intersex and trans people needing gender confirmation surgery. For instance, it is only in the last few years that a well-known brand of testosterone was licensed for use by trans men previously it was used unlicensed for decades and typifies the lack of investment into the health and well-being of trans people. Such short-sightedness continues into the realms of patient-centred consumer health provision. Watch that phrase, I'm still looking for such a concept. Despite EU free movement of goods and services, choices of surgeon and provider are UK-centric, denying trans people the benefit of the latest surgical techniques, that it is not only more suited for the individual, but more cost-effective for the public purse. In the area of genital surgery, fraught with risk versus patient benefit, the choice for trans women is currently of two surgeons in the whole of the UK using similar techniques. And for trans men, it is just one single team, although commissioning did attempt to justify that indeed choice was possible. The choice to have NHS funding sometime, possibly, or pay privately for the same team. I think in summary, the possibility of medical advances must be viewed in the context of the trans experience. And for most, it is rendered to the world of wishful thinking. Just yesterday, the Fundamental Rights Agency in the EU have published a new report. It's titled Trans People in the EU, A Life in Dignity and Free from Discrimination, Not Possible, The Human Rights Commissioner states, from a human rights and healthcare perspective, no mental disorder needs to be diagnosed in order to give access to treatment for a condition in need of medical care. Furthermore, in addition to this, 17 EU countries demand genital surgery leading to sterilisation. I question that this type of eugenics is not an abuse of advanced medical technology. In highlighting the result of collective work by trans activists in Europe, it clearly shows a long road has yet to be travelled before trans people can benefit from a world-class health service that offers world-class commissioning, taking full advantage of medical advancements.
Thank you. Thank you to all of our speakers for some really thought-provoking contributions. We sort of covered the medical, the legal, gender theory, access to some of these things that we're talking about. So now we're going to open it up to questions from the floor.
Thank you very much. I'm Sarah Brown. I'm a trans activist, and I'm possibly also currently the only elected politician in the UK who is an out trans activist. I sit on Cambridge City Council. My question really is for Professor Halberstam. And in contrast to transgender people, who I think we do have problems, as she stated, with the way society imposes the rigid gender binary on us, I want to contrast the approach of another group who also have a similar problem, which is the radical feminists. And quite often their response is a puzzling one, and it's to attack trans people, which I think is cruel, and also to slander us in doing that attack by denying the existence of people such as butch trans women who definitely exist. And I wondered if you could just comment on that phenomenon.
Thank you.
I was just wondering in relation to Judith's talk as well, is it a utopian goal to try and do away with a two-gender system in the way that the situation is framed, or is it to try and create more categories? Because you mentioned the idea of five. I mean, what's the answer in that respect?
I have a similar question there. How would you think about changes in the state and the regulation of gender that might then kind of broaden a binary into a continuous variable?
Okay, well, so let me sort of think through these questions. First of all, the radical feminist critique of transsexuality, I, on the one hand, have to acknowledge it. On the other hand, I have to say it's kind of old at this point. Maybe it's not in the UK. Maybe that's still a really live issue. But in the US, and that's fair enough, that seems to me to be a sort of a retro form of feminism that doesn't acknowledge the construction of gender that, in fact, feminism has been the discourse it has argued for from the beginning. But in the U.S., you know, there was a lot of discussion of Janice Raymond's book, the Transsexual Empire book that came out, I think, in 1978, and that there hasn't been a big feminist lobby other than the Michigan, brouhaha about whether trans women were allowed onto women-only grounds. It seems to me a little bit of a storm in a teacup in terms of the queer communities in urban areas within which feminists, transgender people, genderqueer people, leathermen, and so on sort of interact in diverse ways. So I'm less interested in these internecine fights between feminists and trans people, between gay, lesbian activists and trans people, than I am in this big standoff between some supposedly unmovable force of heterosexuality with gender normativity presumed within it and all of the rest of us. Because somebody partners with transsexual people, and a lot of times they're not other transsexual people, by the way. There are a lot of so-called gender normative people and heterosexual people who are engaged in desiring relationships with people who are not gender normative and who defy the hetero-homo binary as well. So that's what I would say to that. So and that sort of answers your question, is it, Andy, about is it utopian? It's not utopian. It's actually just real. If you live outside of a very, very gender normative framework, you just do know a lot of people who are living in very in-between ways, who sometimes are a he, sometimes a she, who go by male or female names, who have had chest surgery and taken a little testosterone, but are not living as men, or who have breasts but still have penises. There are a lot of genderqueer people out there, and again, they aren't an isolated group with whom no one interacts. You know, the interaction is sort of viral. So it's not about a utopia, oh my gosh, how is this world going to come into being? I'm saying, get with it. We already live in that world. And if you look around, you might be a little bit less sure of the gender of the person sitting next to you. Finally, I'm not arguing for five categories. I'm arguing that we have outgrown a gender binary system. In relationship to the state, we might start asking questions about why the state needs to know your gender. Why does it need to know your... Why do you need that on your driver's license? Why? Why does a gender... an M or an F have to be on your passport? For what reason? Okay, is this going to stop a terrorist attack if they know if you're male or female? So start asking questions about why the state needs to know things, and don't be satisfied with questions like, well, we need answers like, we need to know whether it's a mother or a father. Why? Why do we? Are these anachronistic forms of regulation that go back to the 19th century and the imposition of capitalism? Are these... You know, what regulations go along with these seemingly obvious transactions within which the state asks for information from you and you think it's obvious that you must give it?
Yeah, if I may pick up on this, I said, does it really matter? And I, for one, am of the opinion it shouldn't really matter whether you're the mother or the father of the child. It should matter whether you're the parent. And so what does the gender have to do with it? And we can do away with these categories. We can use primary carer, describing the function in the relationship to the child. So we don't really need these concepts. And there's many of these concepts that are very, very gendered still hidden in some pockets of the law. And I don't think they fit with the way we live our lives today. And perhaps they never fit with the way lives were lived, but they are there. So we can do away with mother and father. And... the vehicle, of course, for this, which sort of brings this to our attention, are the challenges that now we see. You know, we can have a man giving birth. So obviously that leads us to asking questions. And lawyers are usually a bit slower to answer than most people because we have to be sure we're not liable for anything. We don't need these categories, really. Parent is fine. And then you move away from that. So if I have a 3-year sabbatical at some point, then I would actually like to sort of degender the law, and sort of go through the entire law and see whether you can do away with these categories. And most of the time we actually find, no, we don't need the category, actually. It's just the thing that we've always had. We've always been binary. Well, officially.
Richard, what do you think about this idea of why we need to know, and also about the idea of categories? That
well, I agree that there's no relevance to knowing. I mean, I absolutely agree with Jack. I mean, to me, it's always been redundant and senseless at the same time to have things like driver's license, passports, all these things designating a gender. I mean, it's completely irrelevant. This country went through absolute, you know, administrative torment over the years with the people who are transsexual trying to change their birth certificates. I mean, it just went on for decades. And there were about 7 major cases that went, first failed here, that went to the European Court, Tool of the famous model and many others. And eventually the European Court got fed up waiting for this country to change itself. I mean, it would completely irrelevant. You would think that the nation's bookkeeping system would collapse if 1 out of 15,000 people decided to change whether they were male or females, if it was at all relevant. So I'm absolutely in accord with that. Whether that's going to impact, however, on individuals who are convinced, for whatever reason, maybe they're victims of a binary society, but there are people who parade in every day to the Charing Cross Gender Identity Clinic who are convinced that they are living in the wrong sex. And they are, maybe they're victims of the binary society, but the fact of the matter is they are there, and they have a need, and they have a need that was ignored for centuries, if not for decades in the 20th century. They were medical orphans, really, until the 1970s, when they were adopted first by Harry Benjamin and others to meet what they demanded of their own needs with respect to gender and sexuality. So how they got there might be a victim of society, but they're there. And while there might be, in fact, you know, a broadening of genders and lifestyles, et cetera, which is fine, these people are suffering for whatever reason, and medicine can't ignore them.
Ben, do you want to add to that?
I mean, I totally agree, actually, with what Richard has just said. Medicine can't ignore them. And I think at the end of the day, which I think is what Jack was alluding to, is we live in the real world, and there is lots of gender variant people out there, because in your real life you have lots of balls to keep up in the air, to juggle with your career, your family, your loved one, to tell, I feel like this but not like that, can I do it, can't I, will my world collapse? So we take all sorts of actions as we try to survive and travel through life. I think, so it's certainly a fact that people are far more gender variant than society generally gives credit for. The issue of transsexuality, the historical notion that transsexual people were all scripting, they were liars. Well, hell, you know, if I want to get to Cambridge, I've got to have some really good A-levels, I guess. Whatever you want, I'll tell you. And that's what trans people did. Doesn't make them bad people. Doesn't make them not credible or in need of treatment. So I think that's something to say, and I think that psychiatry should get over. I think another just quick point that I would just sort of throw out there is that it's not just transsexual people, this very narrow definition, that need the help in the times we live in of a gender identity clinic, for whatever reason. And I do feel that these centres need to offer a broader range of help to cater for all transgender people.
The doctor said that something about going through sex change and having problems with sort of suicide and stuff like that. I was wondering what the panel's feeling were on mental health of people who couldn't come to terms with what they were going through or coming to terms with it and not being able to do anything about it. For instance, Caribbean immigrants often suffer from higher levels of schizophrenia and mental health coming over to the UK and living in a different society. And I was wondering, growing up with all those feelings, would that be a trigger for mental health conditions if their gender problems weren't treated?
Sorry, this is a gatekeeper question for Richard Green. I just wondered if you could give us an idea of how many people are rejected in this process, and also just to, this is a clarification point, I mean, I really don't have any sense of what the psychological tests are to see if one really thinks they are the other gender rather than they simply want to be. So I just want to hear a little bit more about that process and about those that don't succeed in it.
Hi, my name is Michelle Bridgman. I'm a psychotherapist working in this field, but I've actually got a question for Jens. The Gender Recognition Act is a deeply flawed act, in my view, because it's very exclusive. And what's happened is that people that don't have a gender recognition certificate are actually more discriminated against than they were before the Act, so they're actually worse off. And I wondered if you could comment on what you see as developments within Europe on this. We've already talked about the need for people to explore, and I quite agree with what Jack said about allowing for a kind of population of cells until you arrive at the right place, and yet we have an Act which actually encourages people to stay within a binary system, and not only that, you can't even then be true to a religious faith or a conviction of being married to somebody, and it's a complete anomaly. So I'd be interested to know what you think of that.
Thank you. Jens, do you want to start with that?
Yeah, obviously a very difficult question. Now, lawyers are often just accused of just reacting. And obviously in this case, this was the question put before us, do we allow people to change their gender? And that's what we came up with. I fully agree that the marriage bar is, in my view, is not tenable one. We shouldn't have it. And if we degendered marriage, for example, as some jurisdictions have done, it doesn't matter what your gender is, you can get married, which particularly if you do not have a gender, which is possible in a number of jurisdictions, particularly for intersexuals, then obviously you were barred from any form of meaningful legal relationship because you either had to be male-female or male-male, female-female. Now, if that pattern moves away, then we can do that as well. But these so far are not the questions we've been asked to solve as lawyers. As I said earlier, lawyers are usually the last ones, and so we will have to react to the questions that are put before us. So the more often these questions are asked, and the more this comes to the forefront of what the society desires, lawyers will act. Now, I do have my own political opinions on this, but I don't think they matter so much in this context. It's really the pressure that needs to be exerted for us to actually effect this change and address these issues in law as well. But the law usually reacts rather than acts.
Is there any resistance in the legal community, do you find, or...?
Well, most of the lawyers are probably just as binary as the majority of the society, and there's often things we haven't really thought about. Now, when I give a dinner talk in Cambridge, which you occasionally have to do, I always bring up the man giving birth, and everyone looks at me and goes, "What?" And I say, "No, sorry, it's reality. It's the way it works." And say, "No, it can't be." I say, "Well, yes, it is. So deal with it." And so, I mean, even these people who sort of are probably learned corporate lawyers or successful commercial barristers, they've never thought about these characters, these issues. So what needs to be done is to make us think about these issues.
I wanted to respond a little bit to the question about looking for the psychological consequences of a particular ideology or gender ideology. And the example you used was that there's a higher incidence of schizophrenia in Caribbean immigrants coming to this country. Again, I would go to a structural explanation there and think about how deep racism must be in this country that you see this high level of schizophrenia among racialized immigrants coming to the UK. I wouldn't be particularly looking within the Caribbean immigrant for why there's a higher incidence of schizophrenia. I'd want to know about the racism in the culture. And that's where I think your question was going, was what's the point of looking to the patient to say, oh my gosh, well, people are coming in convinced they're the wrong sex. People aren't convinced they're the wrong sex. They know what sex they are. They don't think it's a wrong sex. They don't think they're going through a wrong puberty. They don't think there's something wrong with them. They don't understand why their gender expression somehow has fallen out of this very narrow system that's in place. I know I grew up thinking of myself as male and masculine. I didn't think I was wrong Exactly. I just didn't see where I was supposed to fit in the gender schema that was around me. Now, it is true that not everyone's able to do that, to project out the problem onto the structure rather than internalize it. So people who internalize it do end up thinking there's something very wrong with them. And that's another argument for sort of freeing up the gender system, not to get beyond it. You can't get beyond categories. We need categories to even understand who we are in relation to one another. But the binary system is obviously doing a certain kind of work that has to do with capitalism, has to do with the family, has to do with all kinds of structures of sexual regulation. It doesn't have to do with the diversity of the population at large.
I don't actually have any sort of comment to that particular point.
Richard, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, there was the issue about, you know, suicidality and the stress of gender issues. I mean, anecdotally at least, it's probably true that, you know, prior to any kind of medical attention being paid to transsexuals in the last 50 years, it's been there since, you know, obviously Venus Castina was around a couple million years ago. It's been there a long time, and depression and suicidality was reportedly very common in people who are absolutely desperate, and there was nowhere to turn, really, until Harry Benjamin, who's known as the father of transsexualism, you know, reached out to these medical orphans and offered some assistance. Do they do better with the attention? I published a paper many years ago, actually with a postoperative transsexual in Los Angeles. We reviewed 10 years follow-ups on everybody in English language literature, and the vast majority, at least 90% of the people after reassignment, were doing much, much better psychologically than before. So it's very helpful to those people who came forward, at that time at least, and asked for help. Now, the question about how many people rejected, it's not a question necessarily of how many are rejected. First of all, nobody actually keeps an actuarial basis of what happens to all the people who come to the clinic. There are about 600 referrals a year to the Charing Cross Clinic. And what, you know, that question being rejected, there are some people who have a very protracted experience at the gender program at Charing Cross and may or may not decide ultimately after many years to go forward with reassignment, to live as they are somewhere between where they were at birth and where they thought they might be going and live out their lives in that way. And the in terms of psychological tests, no, there aren't any psychological tests that are actually given to people who come to the clinic. The clinicians listen to what the people have to say. And it's very, very difficult at any age to articulate, you know, why you want to be male or female. And if a person says, well, I feel like a male or I feel like a female, it's really hard. I can tell you that being a male, it's hard to say what it means to feel like a male. And if you have somebody with a female body saying, I feel like a male, I think it's even more problematic, which is why the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association with the Standards of Care fell back to the position of the so-called, initially called real life test, and then the real life experience. If this is something you feel that you need to do, then you really ought to be able to demonstrate that it works for you. And if it works for you during this trial period, then the medical people are then available to help you more effectively continue to live your life that way.
Just very quickly to respond, one thing that I want to say about using suicide, this is a very sensational kind of discourse that we have, that without medical help, people are going to kill themselves. And there's been a rash of teen gay suicides in the U.S., and people are talking in those terms about watching out for youth who are at risk. The thing, and you weren't doing that, Richard, but the thing is about suicide, suicide's a very complicated act. And if a heterosexual young man kills himself, who's to say it wasn't because he was heterosexual? It could have been. There could have been many reasons that his heterosexuality was imposing a pressure on him that led him to suicide that will never be given as the reason. Similarly, when young heterosexual women kill themselves, a lot of different reasons are given that could be summarized as heterosexuality, but in general it will be like body image problem, or they had a problem with their boyfriend or family. Those are symptoms of a problem with heterosexuality, but heterosexuality isn't seen as the cause. So when a transgender person expresses suicidal feelings, that's a sense of, you know, it's an internalized sense of frustration with the society in part, but it might also be something else. Suicide is something that not a lot of people do. It's a very radical act, and it shouldn't be taken and framed in a cause and effect kind of logic. People who present themselves to clinicians as being in trouble are also not necessarily representative of all of those other people who don't present themselves to clinicians and, in fact, are happy to have opted out of both normativity in relationship to sex and gender. Because there are really toxic problems with normativity, too. And you only have to look at eating disorders among heterosexual women to think about how that works.
Really question so much as sort of musing. I wonder if it's really that the binary is intrinsically so dangerous and oppressive, and would a multiplicity of the five positions be any less so? If you think of coloured, black and white, it's the history of the relationships between the three terms rather than the two terms, in a sense, that make for the differences. That's one bit of musing. I mean, is it the actual nature of the way we categorise, or is it the oppressive history within that categorisation? That leads me to another bit of the musing, which goes on to the third and final bit of the musing, which is, in one sense, I'm not a radical feminist, and it's quite easy for me to imagine a completely liberal attitude to the reality. I agree with you, Judith, completely. It's reality. People are transgendered and they are out there with breasts and penises and the lot. And thank goodness, in a sense, and let's accept it and get on with life. But I think that when you come to thinking about birth, we don't say it's human or it's a giraffe. We say it's a girl or a boy. And we could get rid of that categorization, but it is touching down on something much more difficult than just a liberal position, in a sense. It is touching down on kinship and on heterosexuality and reproduction. And I think that's the end of my musing.
Thank you. And there's one more just next. Yeah.
My research is suggesting that the mean average age that trans people come to realise their gender variance is 7 years, 11 months, with the modal average at 5. Yet the majority appear not to come out until they're well into the adulthood.
42, doesn't this, by the way. 42. I read that just today. One wonders, doesn't one?
I think 42 is the average age for GRS, I think. Doesn't this suggest that gender variance is A, natural, and B, under a lot of pressure to conform to gender normativity?
Thank you. And one more just at the end here, yeah.
My question kind of leads off that. My question has to do with parenting. And I'm part of the Center for Gender Studies. I'm an MPhil student, and we've talked a lot about parenting. And in one particular lecture, Marcia Inhorn was mentioning that nowadays, a lot of times, people will have children for their own psychological benefit, the joy of having a child and rearing it and watching it grow up, and as a couple or by yourself, however you choose to have a child, can bring you all of these wonderful effects in your life. But if that child doesn't fit into what is considered normal, there are often a lot of parents that are then forcing those children, you know, to be a certain way, putting that girl in dance class and musical theater or whatever, and putting that boy in certain sports, and really forcing these particular gender roles on these children. So how do you address the parenting of this, and how do we... I don't know what my question... where am I going with this? How do we help the parents to see that, get out of this gender binary so much?
Okay, thank you.
Hello, I'm afraid my question again is to Professor Halberstam, and I apologize for the huge numbers being directed towards you. But essentially, you reference the idea of an opposition between gender normativity and transsexualism. And I'd be curious, I guess, basically about your thoughts on the idea of a subconscious physical sex, which is advocated by, among others, Julia Serrano and a number of the Dutch research groups working on this. It's basically I would absolutely agree that the gender system that we are stuck with, the binary, is fundamentally broken and probably open to a question as to whether it was ever not broken. We're stuck with it and we should probably do something about that. But I guess to reduce only to the idea of this opposition seems to ignore the feelings that a large number of trans people report about the discomfort with the physical reality of their bodies. And that seems to be less... that the physical dysphoria, which is less an issue of the gender system and more the physical nature that they are confronted with. So I guess people report this regardless of whether they do or don't identify within the gender binary. And I would be curious as to whether you feel it is more complicated than a simple opposition between traditional gender roles and transsexualism, or whether there is in fact an additional component there.
Okay, thank you. Do you want to maybe deal with that? And also the first question, is five better than two?
Yeah. The first question was not, is five better than two? The first question was really right on by saying you're not just arguing against a binary for the sake of it, right? You're arguing against the way it's enforced, which is exactly right. And I'm also arguing against the basis upon which we have a binary system, which is, well, there are two sexes in nature, and therefore there are two genders. Well, if we actually know that there are more sexes in nature and that there are more gender expressions than sufficiently are encapsulated by male-female, then surely we have a much more complicated gender system than the one, to go to your question, that is regularly enforced by parents who are extremely worried about their children standing out in a way that might lead them to be bullied. I mean, what you really need there is a sort of a notion of queer parenting, is what I call it, where it's not the pregnant man that is such an interesting figure for me, but all of these parenting couples where there's one gender normative partner and one gender queer partner, so that kids grow up understanding that gender authority may not be fixed to male masculinity, for example. It may be fixed to other forms of masculinity, female masculinity or transgender masculinity. And also that normative femininity doesn't always mean heterosexuality. There are lots of ways to recognize alternative forms of kinship and parenting that are already going on, and again, try to universalize them. And that gets in a way to this last point, which is really a well-made point, that we don't now just want to have a gender normative versus gender transgressive binary in place of the one that we already had. Lots of transsexual people want to be gender normative, and it's actually part of the quest. Plus, there's that bodily dimension of really feeling at odds with one's embodiment that has to be addressed, and that people like Richard have spent their careers trying to address, right? So here again, though, one could universalize the problem, because we do have examples in our culture of many, many different kinds of people who feel at odds with their bodies. And I don't want to say there's any kind of one-to-one relationship between all different forms of bodily discomfort, but it may be, philosophically speaking, that to be embodied is to be at odds, that it isn't easy to be embodied in the time that we live, and that gender... contrary gendering is one form of bodily discomfort. Feeling that you should have a much larger penis, for example, might be another. Feeling that you should have larger breasts might be another. But we generally just cater to those populations with outlandish surgeries and imagine that they're actually, you know, perfectly reasonable, rather than speaking in terms of pathology and deviance. So I'm trying to depathologize the language without arguing simply to do away with categorization altogether. We're invested in categories, but we should be more creative about what they are.
Richard, what do you think about the parenting point, and maybe some of the parents that you've met in your work?
Yeah, well, I don't have a lot to say about the parenting. I can say, however, that I've seen a lot of children of transsexual parents, which is not exactly the question I was asked, and they look like conventional kids in the same way that many of the dozens and dozens of children that I assessed years ago of so-called lesbian mothers were all, you know, conventional kids as well. So you have a bit of a paradox in that very often you have a conventional parent and an unusual child, or atypical child. You have atypical parents and you have a conventional child. That's a mystery that
disappointing
remains.
Sometimes.
Well, it's a mystery. Let me just say it's a mystery. With respect to the age, I mean, the age at which people become cognizant of gender dysphoria or whatever you want to call it. There were different routes. There were different types of people who eventually wind up looking like transsexual, transgender people now. And there are two major categories that have been described. And one of them, and particularly for males, people born male, appear to be conventionally masculine throughout their boyhoods and teenage, and not at all gender dysphoric, but evolve into that in later years of their life. Very often they actually are heterosexual men with families who would, in decades into life, evolve, if you will, into a much more female-type identity and present at clinics asking for treatment. And there are others who are from very, very earliest on, from very, very beginning, are aware and manifest behaviorally that they are identified with the other sex. I mean, it's for those latter people that we were talking about the benefits of pubertal suspension, because these people will invariably continue their life as someone who wants to change sex, and they are in fact handicapped in later years by the, if you will, the stigmata of what they consider to be the wrong puberty. So that there are different ways to get there, and you have to recognize that there's not just one, you know, one formula for becoming who you are with respect to gender or sexuality, but recognize that there are variant groups of people, and each of them has to have a different kind of social, legal, and, if you will, medical accommodation.
Yes. Do you have any thoughts about the age factor? I mean, that came up a lot in the law.
Yes, because most of the statutes actually contain an age limit, and, as I said, in Germany it was struck down, particularly because now we have sufficient evidence that age is not a factor at all. So, I mean, we might well question whether we should have that kind of limit, and many of the other limits. And I think, in the way, the UK statute is a big step forward because it does not require surgery at all. But I would actually like to pick up on a point that I sort of neglected earlier, namely the discrimination of people who did not actually have a certificate. That, of course, is absolutely right. What the lawyers were asked to do with the Gender Recognition Act was to perpetuate the binary system, and that's what they did. And, of course, that means if you don't fit within the system, then the discrimination has not gone away. But very often what happens, if you fix one thing, then everyone leans back, pats themselves on the shoulder and said, well done, now we don't need to look at it anymore. And I think that's wrong. We do need to look at it continuously, and that's what the challenge is. So do challenge the legal gender.
Ben, do you have any final thoughts about any of this?
I think my sort of issues with some of this is really about state control of gender, and really kind of relating to some of the things that Jack's been saying. I don't quite know what happened. I'm a child of the 60s, and I remember something called unisex, and anything was sort of any which way but loose. And we experimented, and I thought that we'd reached a level of understanding by the 70s where people were sort of less bipolar, if you like, about gender and colours. You know, a boy can wear a pink shirt. And it seems all these years on, we haven't actually marched too far forward, and actually we've regressed, and that's a shame. But we have to keep plugging the same thing, and eventually we will have change, because that is the sensible way for human beings to accept the very nature of other human beings.
Can I make one further?
Yeah.
May I comment about the Gender Recognition Act and the absence of the requirement of having genital surgery, you know, to change your sex on your birth certificate, etc. There's something paradoxical. I filled out a lot of forms when I was at Charing Cross for people, the application that goes into for the gender recognition sex change. And there's a little section in there that asks for what surgical procedures have been implemented. And there's an area there where I would fill in something like, well, you know, genital surgery was performed, et cetera, et cetera. A person is living as a woman. Blah, blah, blah. And then these were all rejected. These were all sent back to me because they wanted, the committee demanded to know specifically what genital procedures were performed. Well, if you don't have to have genital procedures at all, why were they requesting the specifics of the genital surgeries?
Hmm. Yeah. They shouldn't.
No. So maybe they haven't really caught on to what this issue is about.
It's probably true.
OK, Okay, well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. As Andy said at the start, this is the last of three events on gender and radical biomedical advances we've had. We'll be publishing a podcast of tonight's event on the Guardian's Commenters Free website. There are also podcasts of the first two events if you missed them, and a related series of articles we've been running, so you can continue to debate these issues there. So please join me in thanking our panel and thanking you for coming along.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.